Today, George Clooney is the brand ambassador for Omega. The watch he wears is also known as the Moon Watch, as it was worn during the first manned lunar landing in July of 1979. But even if the claims say it is the watch that went to the moon, it just refers to the brand. The Omega Speedmaster you are about to buy has been created on Earth, and most likely will stay on Earth. I find this interesting because it is not the first time that a trip to the moon is used to sell something. In 18th century, quacks and charlatans do sell necklaces, which, when placed around the neck of a child, protect the teething infant from all associated childish and potentially fatal conditions. The anodyne necklace appears in the advertisements in 1715 and offers a great opportunity to analyze the 18th century uses of text in promotion, advertising, and manipulation of the public. In some ads, Mr. Burchell makes the outlandish claim that his products have been used on the moon. Clooney and Burchell do not assert a truth, but are intended to exploit an effect. In both cases, the association with the moon is aimed at evoking an exotic aura around the product, making it memorable and awakening a sense of awe and mystery towards the features of the object. The gap between the truth of a statement and its effect is central in the contemporary analysis of political communication. They are two distinct goals, and in our post-truth age, the effect of a speech on voters is more important than its intrinsic truth. Secular magicians, and in particular stage mentalists, do reflect upon similar ethical issues because when they perform extraordinary feats, some members in the audience may conclude that actual superpowers are at work. Ghosts can be evoked during a seance, and water can be found with a dowsing rod. Preparing this talk, I have cherry-picked five episodes from the life of a colleague of mine, the P.T. Barnum of the Revolutionary Age, the Belgian magician Etienne Gaspard Robertson. Every story casts a light on the topic of this meeting, providing an excellent point of entry into the mindset of that time and its relations with the theme of illusion, credulity, and credibility. In 1798, Robertson starts a show called Phantasmagoria. Through the use of projectors, live actors, and mechanism disguised with smoke and mirrors, he creates a convincing impression of the appearances of ghosts. If you take him a portrait of your beloved deceased, he can make you speak with her soul the day after. He is not the first in Paris pretending to contact the dead. Just a few years before, the Count of Cagliostro from Palermo used magic tricks to reproduce the same supernatural experience. With his paraphernalia and occult language, the Italian necromancer persuaded a lot of people to reverence him as wonder worker. Part of his aura was due to the noble titles he claimed, albeit fake. Prince of Trebizond, Marquis of Harrat, Count Cagliostro, etc., etc., etc. He even claimed to be born under a lucky star, suggesting that his mystical powers were due to astrological influences. But Cagliostro and Robertson are separated by a guillotine. On 1793, the blade falls on the king's head, beheading not only an individual, but also the concept of royalty, rights of blood, and transcendent powers. And while Cagliostro's ghosts were intended to create beliefs, trigger a sense of awe designed to gather a following of worshippers, Robertson's Revenant offer a theatrical experience in which entertainment is more important than belief. Robertson aims at creating a mix of astonishment, fear, and surprise, but his mission is tricky, because as he explains in his autobiography, a single step separates astonishment and credulity. In order to avoid the risk of turning his spectators into believers, he has to balance his performances between enchantment and disenchantment. This systematic program starts from the first page of his autobiography. Commenting his birth in Liegi in 1763, Eve writes, "No prodigy signaled my birth. The sky did not, I think, owe me any particular attention." But in a footnote, he adds tongue-in-cheek, I take this opportunity to recall that the same year, 1763, the Opera Theater was hit by fire. But I confess that I do not think this accident honors my birth. Evoking the image of a theater full of smoke and flames, the episode is a symbolic anticipation of his future theatrical performances. Le citoyen Robertson, as he is always cited on newspapers, does not use Cagliostro's noble titles, nor he claims any belief in astrology or predetermination. Yet, he likes to play with symbols and stories, citing in a footnote a seemingly insignificant episode, which hints at something undefined but slightly uncanny. During his trip to Paris, a stop in a small church is the occasion of writing about a magic painting hosted in a chapel in Corfu and used by visitors as a life detector. Robertson writes, "The strangers who had the curiosity to know if their friends were dead or alive approached this image and put a coin on it, thinking on one of their friends. If the person they were inquiring about was alive, the piece attached itself to the image, but if that died, the coin fell into a bag underneath, so that whether the person was dead or alive, the priest was assured of having the coin." Set up the scene, Robertson lifts the veil from the mystery and explains. With a little attention, one soon noticed that all the pieces were attached to one and the same place, while all those applied elsewhere fell to the ground. The picture is painted on the wall and very shining. We can guess that the priest was careful to not allow the paint to dry. I haven't found any independent reference to this story, but if I were in Corfu, I would do my best to locate the painting, an object involving fate, fraud, and greediness around the typical anxiety of human beings to know whether the beloved one is dead or alive, in an epoch where no mobile phones were available. A few years before, a scientific commission has dismissed mesmerism and its phenomena as nothing but an effect of the imagination. The shivers of terrors and the screams of fears evoked by Robertson ghosts are similar effects, illusory stimuli with the actual physical effects. But how far this process can go? And now for the not the placebo but the nocebo effect. The magician cites an horrific experiment performed on a criminal sentenced to death. The man is blindfolded, tied on a table, and apparently wounded with a knife at four limbs. But the blade does not pierce the skin, and the body is not injured in any way. At the extremities of the table, four small fountains were placed, filled with warm water, which flowed gently into the tubs intended for this purpose. The patient, believing that it was in his blood, gradually fainted. And what kept him in terror was the conversation in a low voice of two doctors placed purposedly in that place. Approaching the other, one of the doctors asked in a low voice, but so as to be heard by the criminal, "How much blood is there in the human body?" 24 pounds, but 10 pounds are just flown out. This man cannot still be alive. Then they gradually moved away and spoke lower. The silence which reigned in the room and the sound of the fountains which still flowed so weakened the brain of the poor unfortunate man, who was, however, a strongly constituted man, that he died little by little and died without losing a drop of blood. To be honest, I don't know where to locate my belief in relation to this story. Reporting the story, Robertson provides a weak bibliographical reference. I haven't located the original clip so far. But if you want to get on the hunt for the article, consider that he declares of having found it in a journal of the year 2 in the French Republican calendar. It corresponds to the period from 22 September 1793 to 21 September 1794. And then there is the story of the two Italians of good appearance and proper dress who came to Robertson's house. They entered into conversation by questions about the phantasmagoria and asked me if there were any people who thought I was a sorcerer and who addressed me to discover robberies. He added that his friends possessed a means as singular as it was infallible for this kind of discoveries. I began to suspect something, but I was curious to be informed of their secret and proposed them to test it for me. For a few days before, a silver box had disappeared from the antechamber. Then they asked for several keys, all of which were not suited to effect the charm. One after another, they placed them on balance at the end of the index finger, naming several persons, reciting aloud for each one a verse from the Psalm of David. At the moment when the name of the guilty person would be pronounced, the key had to turn of its own accord. I should have laughed heartily at this impudent juggling if I had not sought to penetrate the art of the fraud. After the keys of the furniture, they tried the keys of the doors and even proposed to submit to the ordeal the key of the gate. I suddenly came to the thought that they employed this rude artifice only to procure the imprint of the principal key, one of them probably concealing wax intended for this purpose. Duplicates of key had been singularly multiplied in that period, and nothing was heard by stories of theft without breaking the door nor breaking in. I asked them to put an end to their ploy, and I dismissed them abruptly. I love the multi-level deception involved in this flam. The two scammers take advantage of a common belief, the idea that if you put a key in an unstable balance, it will start to rotate by itself when pronouncing the correct word. Take, for example, this oracular procedure described in an 1862 book. It explains how to find out the two first letters of a future husband's or wife's name. You have to put a key in a Bible in correspondence to a specific verse and suspend the book, putting your forefinger under the bow of the key and the forefinger of another person under the other side of the bow. The person should repeat the verses while you say the alphabet. When you arrive to the letter corresponding to the name, the book will turn around. Robertson's story is interesting because the actual working of the method is pointless. The two scammers could say, whether it's true or false, what does it matter? Because the primary target is not to sell the thief detector the technique, but to make a copy of Robertson's keys. The ineffective method is used to distract the attention from the bigger scam. And the last story. At the convent of the Capucines near the Place Vendôme, Robertson installs a museum show, a sort of interactive sideshow with optical illusion, trompe-l'œil effects, panorama scenes, and scientific oddities. The first room hosts 26 pieces. The item 5 is a picture representing a landscape. When it is rotated 90 degrees, it shows an old man's head. The item 15 is a monocle, making the object visible through the wall, based on a hidden system of mirrors. The item 20 is a mirror offering oracular replies to 200 different questions. The following room is dedicated to the most discussed item. It is called the Gallery of the Invisible Women. The official catalog presents the experience like this. We see in the bottom of this gallery a glass chest slightly suspended and in absolute isolation. The voice of a young invisible person is heard answering all the questions, sighing, blowing on the hand presented to her, and describing the object offered to her. The mystery of the invisible women is widely discussed on newspaper and speculation include the possibility that it is no illusion at all, but it involves genuine invisibility. According to one magazine, to be stylish, one must speak in society of nothing else. Spoiling the trick, a pamphlet published in Paris reveals the secret. A woman is cossed in the roof of the room from where she can look down on the proceedings through a hole. The woman's voice passes through a speaking tube running down into the wall of the lower chamber. The interesting point here is that the debate between skeptics and believers may miss the symbolic value of the operation. Trying to locate the belief in relation to the experience, one may overlook some crucial questions. Why a woman, for example? The social historian John Matlock notes that the invisible woman shows burst into the popular imagination at precisely the moment when women's public visibility was most fervently debated. Philip Ball explains that after the revolution, girls in France had the temerity to run around morning and night with complete liberty, and fathers would give their fortunes to make their daughters as invisible as the lady in the box. In a letter to a newspaper, a female correspondent expressed an ambivalent attitude towards it. On one side, her husband is demanding her to emulate the illusion and vanish. On the other, when invisible, you can be ugly and still receive the most flattering compliments. It is no coincidence that the most famous grand illusions in the history of magic involve women, and women only, who are tortured, cut in half and vanished with much applause. Reviewing my documentary, Women in Half, the Italian writer Michela Murgia comments that after seeing it, you won't be longer interested in the trick behind the performance, because the why is more interesting than the how. Searching for a deeper meaning beyond the rigid dichotomy between true and false requires a fundamental ability, the one to embrace illusions without relinquishing an awareness of their contingent status as human creations. That's one of the lessons I've learned from Robertson, a master in the art of triggering in his audience that form of enchantment in which one can be delighted without being deluded. Thank you.